Today is December 5th, and our class is on men and women in the Talmud, Talmudic literature. And today we're going to see men and women in the Talmudic literature as it relates to Hanukkah, believe it or not. And we could call the subject, heroism and cheese. Heroism and cheese.
Oh, heroism. I thought you said heroin.
And I organize the sources in an interesting fashion. It's like a mystery. We're going to go through some sources and try and figure out what's going on. The first page is page 2, as you can see. This is no page 1. I photocopied this on paper from 5 years ago of the Community Kollel. I used these sources then. So we're doing heroism and cheese. That's the subject.
Can I spell the second word?
Cheese.
Like
C-H-E-E-S-E. If that's too hard to spell, make it heroism and milk.
And cheese.
And milk product.
Got it.
So the first source is the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. We're in Egypt in the very end of the 11th century. Hilchot Megillah and Hanukkah, chapter 3, law 1. During the period of the Second Temple, the Hellenistic kings, that means the Greek kings, legislated restrictive legislation against the Jewish people and didn't permit them to learn Torah to keep the commandments. And of course, that's the genesis of the Hanukkah story. We're about 160 years before the Common Era. They ravaged their property and their womenfolk, and they entered the sanctuary and perpetrated abominations upon it. They defiled the holy things. The Jews were sorely pressed and greatly troubled, until the God of their forefathers had mercy upon them and redeemed them and saved them. The Hasmonean high priest prevailed and killed them and redeemed the Jewish people from their hand. That's the basic story of Hanukkah, and we understand that we know it. It all has its sources in the books of the Maccabees, which we'll talk about later, book 1 and book 2. But there's one detail that the Rambam mentions that doesn't have a foundation in the historical sources of the books of the Maccabees. And that is in the third line of what we read, the mention of women, women folk. It says that the Greeks ravaged their property and their women folk. So the Rambam is referring to something about rape, something about illicit sexual relations, but it doesn't have any source. It's not mentioned in the historical books that talk about the decrees of the Greeks and the miracle of Hanukkah. And the subject for today is to figure out what's going on until we get to some very, very interesting Talmudic literature about the role of women in the Hanukkah miracle. Okay? Here we go.
I don't quite understand who the Hasmoneans are. I know they're the Maccabees were Hasmoneans, but what were Hasmoneans?
We don't actually know today where that word came from, but it refers to that family of Matityahu and his sons. We don't know why it refers to them. But when we talk about the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, we are referring to that family, that clan, actually.
The clan of the Maccabees.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So to try and figure out what the Rambam is talking about when he says that the Greeks ravaged their womenfolk, we're going now to the 16th century. The next source is Rav Moshe Isserles in his comments on the Shulchan Aruch. Here we go. And he writes as follows. There are those who hold that there is a bit of a mitzvah in making festival meals, on Hanukkah it means. In those days, took place the dedication of the altar. Since Hanukkah is about the dedication of the altar, the re-consecration of the temple, well, that's something religious. And therefore, you can make festival meals and have parties about it on Hanukkah. And it is our custom to sing songs and praises to God at these festive meals. And this certainly makes them mitzvah meals. There are those who hold that one should eat cheese during Hanukkah. Did you know that?
Mm-mm, I didn't know that.
An ancient Ashkenazi custom to have cheese and milk products on Hanukkah. There are those who hold that one should eat cheese during Hanukkah, for the miracle was accomplished through the milk that Yehudit fed to the enemy. Here's my last source sheet for Mimi. So here we see that in the 16th century, there's an ancient tradition that we should eat milk products on Hanukkah in memory of a miracle that took place through the agency of milk. And how did it happen? Well, this woman, the name of Yudit, she went to the enemy general, apparently, and fed him cheese or milk, and that's how the miracle happened. Well, not too much information here. Doesn't say at all. But we'll see what story is being referred to and how it relates to the Rambam story about the ravaging of the women folk by the Greek rulers. Okay, so the story is developing here. And now we're going to move to a 20th century source that is commenting upon the source we just read. We just read from Rav Moshe Itzelis in the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century. And now we're going to look at Rav Yisrael Meir Kahan's Mishnah Berurah, Kagan, excuse me, certainly one of the most famous Jewish books written in the whole 20th century. And he's explaining the words that we just read, that Yehudit fed to the enemy. And he gives us background to the story. She was the daughter of Yochanan the high priest. And there was a decree that every bride must first lay with the Greek ruler. And she fed the enemy general cheese to make him drowsy, and she chopped off his head, and they all fled. Now, what exactly is he saying? Well, it looks like there are two different stories that he's putting together. One is a story that there was a decree, and this explains what the Rambam had in mind when he said that the Greeks ravaged the women folk. There was a decree that said that every Jewish bride before her marriage must lay with the Greek ruler. That was the price of marriage. And then there's a separate story of this girl whose name is Yehudit. She fed the enemy general cheese to make him drowsy, the tradition that milk products make you drowsy, milk and cookies before you go to sleep. And she got him woozy, he fell asleep, and she chopped off his head and they all fled. What's the connection between the two stories? Does the Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan mean to say that she was about to get married and she went into the chamber with this enemy general, and instead of immediately having sex, she gave him milk and cookies and he fell asleep and then she chopped off his head? It looks like he's putting these two stories together. And it could be what Rav Moshe Itzelis was referring to, and it could be what the Rambam was referring to. But where does this story come from? It's not found, again, in the historical books of the Maccabees at all. But the point they're making is that we should have cheese on Chanukah in memory of this miracle. Okay? Next page of sources. Comes from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Shabbat, page 23. So we're going back in time, 2,000 years ago. And it says, women certainly are obligated to light the Hanukkah lights. As Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, women are obligated in the Hanukkah lights, for even they were involved in that miracle. Let me give some background. So, we know that there's a rule that says that women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot. Positive meaning that it's an obligation to do as opposed to an obligation to refrain. And time-bound, it has to be done a certain time, and it can't be done any other time. So lighting Hanukkah lights is positive, you have to light, and it's time-bound. It can't be on Pesach or Rosh Hashanah, you have to light the Hanukkah lights on Hanukkah. It's a positive time-bound mitzvah. And therefore, according to the rule, women should be exempt. Only men do it, not women. But the Talmud says, no, that's not the case. Even though it's a positive time-bound mitzvah, still, women certainly are obligated to light the Hanukkah lights. Why? Because they were involved in the miracle. Now, what does it mean they're involved in the miracle? There's two ways to look at it. It could mean that they were involved in the decree against Jewish life. They suffered, and they were saved. So, men and women equally suffered and were saved. We should all equally celebrate. That makes sense. Or it could mean something else. It could mean that women were involved in leading the miracle, in creating the salvation. And if that's what it means, we see the connection to what we talked about for the last 5 minutes. Yehudit saved the Jewish people, according to the story that we read, by somehow getting the guy drowsy and cutting off his head. So because a woman was at the vanguard of the miracle, she saved the Jewish people, therefore all women should celebrate, not just men, by lighting the Hanukkah candles. You with me?
But are women not obligated to light Friday night candles? Because, you know, you always see the women do it.
Right. The answer is, we won't go into it now.
Okay.
There's a rule that says women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvot, but there's more exceptions to the rule than there are cases that adhere to the rule.
Okay.
There's about 65% exceptions and 35% that hold to the rule. So now, we're moving to something that seems to be unrelated, but we'll see the connection. In the Babylon Talmud tractate Pesachim, it says, said Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, women are obligated in the four glasses of wine at the Passover Seder, for even they were involved in the miracle. Now, drinking four glasses of wine on Passover is a positive time-bound mitzvah. You would think that women are exempt, because it's a positive time-bound mitzvah, but no. The halacha says women are obligated, just like they're obligated to light the Hanukkah candles, because, the same words, even they were involved in the miracle. What does it mean, even they were involved in the miracle? Does it mean even they were saved? Even they were slaves and they were saved? Does it mean that they made the miracle? They led us out of Egypt? Does it mean they were the leaders or they were the participants?
I think they were equal partners. Or they were partners.
Partners in the what? In the suffering? Or in the creation of the miracle?
Creation of the miracle.
So who is the Jewish leader who led us out of Egypt?
Oh.
The Jewish female leader. Well, that's the next source. Rashi explains, for even they were involved in the miracle. I don't have any more sources. You have to look on. As it said in Tractate Sotah, that as the reward for the righteous women who lived in that generation were the Israelites delivered. And the reference is to a story that we may see in another 2 weeks, that the women saved the Jewish people. That the men decided that the decrees of power were so serious, we would no longer have any children. But the women decided, no, you have to keep hope, you have to keep having children, and because of the merit of their faith, the Jewish people were redeemed. So according to that approach, it's not that women suffered and were saved equally with men. It's that women did the saving. They were the leaders. And since they were the leaders that caused the Jewish people to be saved from Egypt, therefore, women participate equally in the celebration. That's the way it is for Passover, according to Rashi's interpretation. And then let's read on Rashi. And so concerning the reading of the Megillah, the same is said, that women are obligated because through Esther we were delivered. That's what happens on Purim. Reading the scroll of Esther on Purim is a positive time-bound mitzvah. Women should be exempt. But no, women are obligated. Why? Because even they were part of the miracle. Wasn't part of the miracle? Not that they were saved, but they did the saving. Why were we saved? How were we saved? Through the greatness of Esther. So you see that on Passover, the miracle was created and led by women. That's why women celebrate together with men. On Purim, the miracle was created by a woman. That's why women celebrate together with men. And the same thing on Hanukkah. It's not that the women suffered and were saved together with men. Rather, the women created the miracle. They led the revolt against the Greeks. It was Yehudit who saved the Jewish people. And therefore, two things. Therefore, women light the Hanukkah candles, even though it's a positive time-bound mitzvah. And secondly, we eat cheese on Hanukkah to remember the miracle in which Yehudit saved the Jewish people by feeding the enemy general cheese and making him drowsy and cutting off his head. Now everyone says, wait a second, we never heard this story before. They never taught us this in Cheder. So that's why we're here.
So where is that story from?
From the pages in our hands.
No, but it's not in the...
We're about to get to it.
There are a lot of Renaissance paintings that show that scene.
Right.
But she's giving him wine, I believe.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. There's lots of different paintings.
Okay.
Lots of different paintings. So now we're skipping the source at the bottom of page 3, because we're going to see that story another 2 weeks, I think. We're going to the top of page 4. And now we're in Rashi's commentary on the Talmud. We're in the 11th century in northern France. And Rashi's explaining the miracle because of which women are obligated to light the Hanukkah candles. And we're expecting something about Yehudit and something about cheese, right? And something about the brides going into the leader of the enemy the night before. And what does Rashi say? And indeed, that's what he says. For the Greeks decreed upon every virgin to be married that they must first lay with the Greek ruler, and through a woman was the miracle accomplished. So Rashi doesn't tell us the name Yehudit, doesn't tell us anything about cheese, not anything about the woman killing the man, but he does tell us a little bit about the decree that on the first night the woman has to lay with the Greek ruler, and somehow from that came the genesis of this miracle through a woman, but Rashi doesn't tell us the whole story. Now we're going to go back to the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Ketubot, page 3b, to read a story that has nothing to do with Hanukkah, but it will connect. The sages watched over the interests of the daughters of Israel, so that the man should prepare for the wedding feast 3 days. The first day in the week, that's Sunday, and the second day in the week, that's Monday, and the third day in the week, that's Tuesday, and the fourth day he marries her. In other words, in ancient times, wedding feasts took place on Wednesday nights. Because in a world where there's no refrigeration, you have to have enough time to prepare all that you have to prepare. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then have it on Wednesday afternoon or Wednesday night. Because if you have it early in the week, then there's only 2 days or 1 day since Shabbat, and you don't have time to prepare everything. You couldn't prepare it on Friday, things will go bad. So you're supposed to get married on Wednesday so that there'll be enough time to provide the bride with a proper feast. And from the time of danger and onwards, the people made it a custom to marry on the third day, not the fourth day, but the third day, and the sages did not interfere with them. It doesn't say why they switched the day, but there was some danger in getting married on Wednesday, so they switched it to Tuesdays. What was the danger? If I say that they said a maiden that gets married on the fourth day of the week shall be killed, then how state they made it a custom? We should abolish entirely. Said Rabbah, they said a maiden that gets married on the fourth day of the week shall first have sexual intercourse with the prefect. So there's a tradition that the rabbis remember that once upon a time there was a law that you have to get married on Wednesdays. And then these people switched it to Tuesdays. And why did they switch it to Tuesdays? Because on Wednesdays, the leader of the enemy, whoever it was, doesn't say what the enemy was, what his name, what historical period, but you have a tradition, a vague historical tradition, that the enemy, the foreign rulers, used to say that if it's a Wednesday wedding, the woman has to lie first with the local general, whatever it is. So the people switched it to Tuesdays to try and get around this decree. Nothing relating to Hanukkah. There's no historical details there. The rabbis don't know when this was, but there was such a thing. Now, we come to the connection between that thing of the decree of lying with the enemy first and the Hanukkah story. We're reading now a source called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit is the oldest written source of oral law that we have. It's written before the destruction of the temple. And this whole Megillah, this whole scroll, is just a list of days on which you're not allowed to fast. One line for each of the 36 days, I think it is, they're not allowed to fast, because something good happened those days, something joyous for the Jewish people. And then there's a commentary that explains what happened on each of these days. The commentary, we don't know when it was written or who wrote it, and we don't even know what historical period. It's from late antiquity or the early Middle Ages, we don't know. It's from the 2nd century or the 4th or the 6th or the 8th, some even say from the 10th. It's an amazing text that is so fragmentary and so unclear with so many different pieces of language, no one knows when it was written. But now we're going to read the commentary. We're going to read the Megillah and the commentary, and we'll see something amazing.
But the oldest written source of the Is that what you said?
The oldest written source of the oral law, in other words, after the Tanakh, is called Megillat Tanit, and it's from the time that the temple was still standing.
But the time you're talking about, we already had. Wasn't the Talmud already?
No, the temple. The temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era. The Talmud only comes hundreds of years later. The Mishnah is in the year 200 of the Common Era. That's also after the destruction.
Okay, right.
But from the destruction time, we have only one written text.
Okay, so what time frame is this?
Before the year 70 of the Common Era.
Oh, okay.
So Megillat Tanit says, on the 17th of Elul, the Romans left Jerusalem. And therefore, you're not allowed to fast on that day. Now, when did the Romans leave Jerusalem? Who knows? What's it referring to? Who knows? When? Who knows? But the commentary, again, written a long time after the Megillah itself, we don't even know when it was written or who wrote it, the commentary says something fascinating. Because they were oppressing the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and on account of them, they were not able to go about their business during the daytime, but rather were forced to do what they needed to at night. And how did the Greek kings oppress them? Uh-oh. You see the contradiction?
Greek, Roman.
Right.
Which one is it?
What's going on? The Megillah says the Romans left Jerusalem. The commentary says because they're oppressing the inhabitants. And it says, how did the Greek kings oppress them? There's a combination of two different texts here. There's a lot of contrary what's going on. It's clearly, there's an effort here by two different authors to explain what is this date of Romans leaving Jerusalem, the 17th of Elul. What we're about to read certainly can't be understood as history. It's an effort to try and reconstruct what's special with the 17th of Elul. It's not history. But it's an interesting tradition. Let's read. And how did the Greek kings oppress them? They appointed kastriot.
What's that?
That is a Greek word, probably, and it means some type of leader.
That almost sounds like my name. Kastan.
Yeah. Perhaps it's related. Who knows? They appointed kastriot in every town in order to afflict the brides. And only afterwards could they marry their husbands. And they prevented Israel from celebrating with their wives in fulfillment of the verse, you shall betroth a woman, another man shall lie with her. That's a curse. And no one took a wife because of the kastriot. And then they began to get married in secret, right? Because if you have a public wedding, then the Greek king is taking the bride. So they did it in secret. Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, had a daughter. And when her time came to get married, the kastrin came to defile her. But they did not let him. Matityahu and his sons acted zealously, and they overpowered and defeated the Greek kingdom and killed them. And the day that they vanquished them, they made into a holiday. We have here an account, and we don't know when it was written. Could be the 2nd century of the Common Era, could be the 10th century. And it gives us more details than we've ever had before in the past half an hour, of the relationship of this woman to the Hanukkah story. So let's see what we read here. We read about the Greeks, so we know it could be related to Hanukkah. We read about Matityahu, we've heard of him in the Hanukkah story. And he has a son that's called Yochanan the high priest, and he has a daughter. So it's a granddaughter of Matityahu, according to this story. She's going to get married. And then we have this decree that she has to first sleep with the kastrin. But they did not let him. So it looks like it's saying that the Maccabees, the brothers of this girl, when they understand that their sister is going to be defiled, they revolt. And they act zealously, and that's the Hanukkah miracle. And that's just like in the book of Maccabees, except for this girl is missing from the book of the Maccabees. This girl, this whole decree of the brides having to lie with the Greek king first. It's all missing from the Maccabees. There's a certain type of tradition that we have here that connects that decree and a certain girl to the revolt. Now, let's try and put things together. This source we're reading right now doesn't mention her name. Doesn't mention her name anywhere. Whereas in the traditions we saw half an hour ago, we saw she has a name, Yehudit. Judith. In this tradition, there's nothing about milk, nothing about cheese, nothing about cutting off the head. Actually, this tradition doesn't say what happened. It just says she was supposed to get married. The Greek ruler came to defile her, and her brothers didn't let them, didn't let him, and then the revolt began. So it doesn't say that she had played any role except for getting being about to be married. So we have more work to do to figure out what actually the story says. And now, I'll reveal to you something you might know. There's a book in the Apocrypha called the Book of Judith. The book Sefer Yehudit. Now, what do I mean the Apocrypha? And if you open up the Jewish Bible, it's in the Torah, there's no Book of Judith. In the other 19 books of the Bible, there's no Book of Judith. But there's a Book of Judith in the canon of the Greek Orthodox Church and in the Catholic Church. Not in the Protestant Church. But the Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church have lots of books in their canon that were written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews before the destruction of the temple. In other words, in the first and second centuries before the Common Era, and these books never made it into the Jewish canon, even though they're written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews.
Why didn't they make the cut?
Why didn't they make the cut? The easiest answer to that is because these books were written after the canon was already closed.
Oh.
Right? The last book of our Bible is written in the 6th century, probably, before the Common Era. Whereas the Book of Judith is from a century or two before the Common Era, after our canon was closed. So these books, again, written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews in ancient times, but the Jewish people didn't include them in the canon, and therefore the Jewish people gradually lost connection to them. Whereas the Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church put them into the canon together with the New Testament, and they've been preserved there. And now we're going to read from the Book of Judith. Now, the Book of Judith is a long book. We can't read the whole thing. But it's going to be the foundation of everything we've been talking about for the past half an hour. You can get it today in English, the Book of Judith, and read it. I have to give some background. The Book of Judith, as far as we know today, is not a historical account. It's a historical fiction, you can call it. It's a novel. Perhaps one of the first novels ever written. It's an interesting, exciting book. It mentions nothing about Hanukkah, nothing about Greeks. The truth is, it is a mishmash of different historical periods. That's one of the reasons that historians say it must be written as a fable, as a novel. It's not a book of history. So what I did here is I summarized the book so that we could read it in 10 minutes. So I shouldn't say summarized. I excerpted the important verses, and I put three dots where I left things out. I left most of the book out. We're going to now read the Book of Judith in abbreviated form. So again, this book was written over 2,000 years ago. And it's not historical work. It seems to be fiction. By this time, the people of Israel living in Judah heard of everything in holy Faunus, the general of Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, had done to the nations. Now he had plundered and destroyed all the temples. Now the Assyrians, they're the people that oppressed the kingdom of Israel going back 700 and 800 years ago. And one of their generals was Nebuchadnezzar. But there's no historical account of holy Faunus.
Of what?
This guy, Holofernes. We don't know where that name comes from. There are those who say it's a Persian word. And again, a Persian general together with the Assyrians, that historically doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't matter. They were therefore very greatly terrified at his approach and were alarmed both for Jerusalem and the temple of the Lord their God. For they had only recently returned from captivity, and all the people of Judah were newly gathered together, and their sacred vessels and the altar and the temple had been consecrated after their profanation. Now, what could it mean, recently returned from captivity? It could mean that it's supposed to be right after the return of the Jews from Babylon, which was 70 years after the destruction of the first temple. But again, historically, there's a mishmash of different things here. When the Jews returned from captivity, the Assyrians were already gone from the stage of world history. So we can't really try to figure out when this happened because it didn't happen. But it's an interesting story. When Holofernes, the general of the Assyrian army, heard that the people of Israel had prepared for war and had closed the passes in the hills and fortified all the high hilltops and set up barricades in the plains, he was very angry. And now I'm skipping a whole chapter. The next day, Holofernes ordered his whole army and all the allies who had joined him to break camp and move against Bethulia. We don't know of any city named Bethulia. It seems to be a made-up name. But again, that doesn't matter. And to seize the passes up in the hill country and make war on the Israelites. So all their warriors moved their camp that day. Their force of men of war was 170,000 infantry and 12,000 cavalry, together with the baggage and the foot soldiers handling it, a very great multitude. They encamped in the valley near Bethulia beside the spring. At that time, Judith, Yehudit, heard about these things. She was the daughter of Merari, the son of Ox, the son of Yosef, the son of Uziel, the son of Elkiah, son of Ananias, the son of Gideon, the son of Raphaim, the son of Achitov, the son of Eliyahu, the son of Chilkiah, the son of Eliyahu, the son of Netanel, the son of Salamiel, the son of Sarastieh, son of Israel.
Very good.
Right.
You can say it in one breath.
Her husband Minashe, who belonged to her tribe and family, had died during the barley harvest. So she's not a bride and she's not a virgin.
She's a widow.
She's a widow. She was beautiful in appearance and a very lovely face, and her husband Manasseh had left her gold and silver and men and women, slaves and cattle and fields, and she maintained this estate. No one spoke ill of her, for she feared God with great devotion. When Yehudit heard the wicked words spoken by the people against the ruler, because they were faint for lack of water, and when she heard all that Uzziah said to them, and how he promised them under oath to surrender the city to the Assyrians after 5 days. So she's a woman of faith, whereas the mayor of the city, Uzziah, is weak-willed, and he wants to surrender the city to the Assyrians. She sent her maid, who was in charge of all her possessions, her chief of staff, to summon Chabris and Charmis, the elders of her city. They came to her and she said to them, "Listen to me, rulers of the people of Bethulia." Judith said to them, "Listen to me, I am about to do a thing which will go down through all generations of our descendants. Stand at the city gate tonight. I will go out with my maid, and within the days after which you have promised to surrender the city to our enemies, the Lord will deliver Israel by my hand." She bathed her body. I'm skipping now a whole chapter. She bathed her body with water and anointed herself with precious ointment and combed her hair and put on her tiara and arranged herself in her gayest apparel, which she used to wear while her husband Menashe was living. And she put sandals on her feet and put anklets and bracelets and rings and her earrings and all her ornaments. And she made herself very beautiful to entice the eyes of all men who might see her. And she gave her maid a bottle of wine and a flask of oil and filled a bag with parched grain and a cake of dried fruit and fine bread. And she wrapped up all her vessels and gave them to her to carry. Then she went out to the city gate of Bethulia and found Uzziah standing there with the elders of the city, Chabris and Charmis. When they saw her and noted how her face was altered and her clothing changed, they greatly admired her beauty and said to her, "May the God of our fathers grant you favor and fulfill your plans, that the people of Israel may glory and Jerusalem may be exalted." And she worshiped God. Then she said to them, "Order the gate of the city be opened for me, and I will go out and accomplish the things about which you spoke with me." So they ordered the young men to open the gate for her, and she, as she has said. When they had done this, Judith went out, she and her maid with her, and the men of the city watched her until she had gone down the mountain and passed through the valley and could no longer see her. The women went straight on through the valley, and an Assyrian patrol met her and took her into custody and asked her, "To what people do you belong? And where are you coming from? And where are you going?" She replied, "I am a daughter of the Hebrews, but I am fleeing from them, for they are about to be handed over to you to be devoured. I am on my way to the presence of Holofernes, the commander of your army, to give him a true report, and I will show him a way by which he can go and capture all the hill country without losing one of his men captured or slain." So you understand, it's all a ploy, right? She's lying. She wants to gain the confidence of the enemy and the enemy general. When the men heard her words and observed her face, for she was in their eyes marvelously beautiful, they said to her, "You have saved your life by hurrying down to the presence of our Lord," meaning our general. "Go at once to his tent. Some of us will escort you and hand you over to him. And when you stand before him, do not be afraid in your heart, but tell him just what you have said, and he will treat you well." They chose from their number 100 men to accompany her and her maid, and they brought them to the tent of Holofernes. There was great excitement in the whole camp, for her arrival was reported from tent to tent, and they came and stood around her as she waited outside the camp of Holofernes while they told him about her. And when Judith came into the presence of Holofernes and his servants, they all marveled at the beauty of her face, and she prostrated herself and made obeisance to him, and his slaves raised her up. And she fell on the ground, and the slaves picked her up. On the fourth day, Holofernes held a banquet for his slave only, and did not invite any of his officers. And he said to Bogoas, the eunuch who was in charge of his personal affairs, "Go now and persuade the Hebrew woman who is in your care to join us and eat and drink with us." So it was a banquet of the enemy general and his slave, and he wants to bring Judith into the banquet. "For it will be a disgrace if we let such a woman go without lying with her, for if we do not do so, she will laugh at us." So Bogoas went out from the presence of Holofernes and approached her and said, "This beautiful maidservant will please come to my lord and be honored in his presence and drink wine and be merry with us and become today like one of the daughters of the Assyrians who serve in the house of Nebuchadnezzar." And Judith said, "Who am I to refuse my lord? Surely whatever pleases him I will do at once, and it will be a joy to me until the day of my death." Wow, she knows how to play it up. So she got up and arrayed herself in all her woman's finery. And her maid went and spread on the ground for her before Holofernes the soft fleeces which she had received from Bogoas for her daily use, that she might recline on them when she ate. Then Judith came in and lay down, and Holofernes' heart was ravished with her, and he was moved with great desire to possess her, for he had been waiting for an opportunity to deceive her ever since the day he first saw her, for the past 4 days. So Holofernes said to her, "Drink now and be merry with us." Judith said, "I will drink now, my lord, because my life means more to me today than all the days since I was born." She says, "It's the greatest day of my life to have a party with you." Then she took and ate and drank before him what her maid had prepared. In other words, she doesn't eat any of the non-kosher food. She brought her own food with her, but she brought wine, at least what looks like wine. So it looks as if she's getting drunk with him. And Holofernes was greatly pleased with her, and drank a great quantity of wine, much more than he had ever drunk in any one day since he was born. When evening came, his slaves quickly withdrew, and Bogoas closed the tent from outside and shut out the attendants from his master's presence, and they went to bed, for they were all very weary because the banquet had lasted long. So Yehudit was left alone in the tent, with Holofernes stretched out on his bed, for he was overcome with wine. Now Judith had told her maid to stand outside the bedchamber and to wait for her to come out, as she did every day, for she said she would be going out for her prayers. And she had said the same thing to Bogoas. In other words, so the enemy, they're used to her going out into the fields every day in the evening. So everyone went out, and no one, either small or great, was left in the bedchamber. Then Judith, standing beside his bed, said in her heart, "O Lord God of all might, look in this hour upon the work of my hands for the exaltation of Jerusalem. For now is the time to help thy inheritance and to carry out my undertaking for the destruction of the enemies who have risen up against us." So she went up to the post at the end of the bed, above Holofernes' head, and took down his sword that hung there. She came close to his bed and took hold of the hair of his head and said, "Give me strength this day, O Lord God of Israel." And she struck his neck twice with all her might and severed it from his body.
She was strong.
Yeah. Strong in more ways than one. Then she tumbled his body off the bed and pulled down the canopy from the posts. After a moment, she went out and gave Holofernes' head to her maid, who placed it in her food bag. Then the two of them went together, and they were as they were accustomed to go for prayer, and they passed through the camp and circled around the valley and went up to the mountain of Betulia and came to its gates. Judith called out from afar to the watchman at the gates, "Open, open the gate. God, our God, is still with us to show his power in Israel and his strength against our enemies, even as he has done this day." When the leaders of the Assyrian army heard this, they rent their tunics and were greatly dismayed, and the loud cries and shouts arose in the midst of the camp. When the men in the tents heard it, they were amazed at what had happened. Fear and trembling came over them, so they did not wait for one another, but with one impulse all rushed out and fled by every path across the plain and through the hill country. Mm-hmm. And the Jewish people were saved, the Assyrian army dispersed and fled, and we all lived happily ever after.
Renting their tunics sounds like a very Jewish thing.
An ancient custom, you show mourning by rending your clothes. It's not just Jewish.
We possibly didn't start it.
No, it's found in the Tanakh, but that again doesn't mean that we started. So now, this story. Let's see what we read and what we didn't read. So we read a story of a woman who saves the Jewish people. Her name is Yehudit. That's good. But what's missing from the story? There was no cheese. No mention of cheese or milk. It says that wine is what was drunken. No mention of cheese or milk. No mention of the historical period. No mention of the period that we call Hanukkah. Right? We don't know when the story took place, because it probably didn't take place at all. So there's no mention of the historical period. There's no mention of Hanukkah. There's no mention of high priests or Maccabees. There's no mention of being a virgin or being betrothed, right? She was a widow. All we have is her name, Yehudit, who saves the Jewish people through her feminine charm. And apparently, this story, which again goes back over 2,000 years, was recrafted and reinterpreted and redacted to combine it and with elements of the Hanukkah story to create the tradition which we began with in the 20th century sources that say that there was a woman Yehudit who was a virgin and who was going to get married and who was brought into the enemy camp and somehow she managed to feed him cheese and chop off his head. That story is a development of the Book of Yehudit that we have here. So once upon a time, and this goes back 20 years ago, I took upon myself to try and figure out the stage in the development of the story. So I got all these manuscripts, and I tried to see all the different midrashim that developed from stage 1 to stage 2 to stage 3 to stage 4. It's a fascinating story. Fascinating. What I want to bring now are just two or three stages in the development of the story until we get to the idea that people have heard or haven't heard today, that there's a Yehudit who fed him cheese, got him drowsy and cut off his head, and today we celebrate Hanukkah because of the greatness of Yehudit by eating cheese.
I'm sorry, can I just ask for goes out and she prays three times a day?
According to the Book of Judith, mm-hmm. It says she goes out in the evening.
Okay, so she goes out and prays, but
it actually relates to the previous class, which we saw that the evening prayer isn't obligatory.
Right.
But apparently she had this custom of going out and praying in the evening. Or she just made it up so that the soldiers were used to her leaving the encampment every evening time. So that when she finally killed him and put his head in the bag, she could leave and they'd be used to her leaving.
Right.
But again, the Judith story has nothing to do with Hanukkah in its original form, and nothing to do with virgins, and nothing to do with cheese. All those elements were added later until we get to the story that is told in our sources today. You're about to say something, Barbara?
I am so confused about this. So, Judith, these were Greeks.
We don't even know what they were. Again, let me just make it clear, we're not talking here about history. We're not talking here about what happened. We're talking about the development of a story from one original book, the Book of Judith, how different elements were added onto the story throughout the generations. It's called the process of Midrash, until a story was created that talks about a woman by the name of Yudit, who is a virgin and is a member of the Maccabean family and lives at the time of the Greek ruling in the land of Israel, who is about to be married and is given over to the Greek ruler, but she manages somehow to feed him cheese and make him drowsy and trap over his head. We're seeing how that story was created over the course of hundreds of years. And just let me say parenthetically, even though I'm claiming that there really was no such thing historically, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have cheese on Hanukkah. Right? I'm not trying to undermine a nice tradition. It's a nice tradition. And the Jewish people have lived by this tradition for a long time. But it really doesn't have any historical foundation. Okay?
I didn't even know you're supposed to have cheese.
Well, run out and buy your cheese.
Fried.
Blitz is sound good.
I'm getting a 10% cut from Tom Thumb on all the cheese sold there for the next week. So we saw in the book of Yudit that she seduces the enemy general and gets him drowsy with wine. But the Hanukkah tradition talks about milk. Where did the Jewish people get the idea of putting milk into the tradition of a woman seducing a man? We got it from the book of Judges. Look at the book of Judges. And this is a book from the Bible, right? From the Tanakh. The book of Judges, chapter 4. And there's a story here of the battles between the Canaanites and the Jewish tribes. And in one of the battles, the beginning of the book of Judges, chapter 4, Sisera is the enemy general that the Jewish people are fighting against. Howbeit, Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Yael, the wife of Hever the Canaanite, because he was defeated. For there was peace between Yavin, king of Hatzor, and the house of Hever the Canaanite. And Yael went out to meet Sisera, and said unto him, "Turn in, my lord, turn in to me, fear not." And he turned in to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. So here's this enemy general. He's been killing on the battlefield. His forces are defeated. He flees, and he finds this tent of this nice woman who gives him a place to hide, and she puts him under the covers. And he said unto her, "Give me, I pray thee, a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." And she opened a bottle of milk and gave him drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand in the door of the tent, and it shall be when any man doth come and inquire of thee and say, 'Is there any man here?' that thou shalt say, 'No.'" Then Yael, Hever's wife, took a tent pin and took a hammer in her hand and went softly up to him and smote the pin into his temples, and it pierced through into the ground, for he was in a deep sleep, so he swooned and died. And then in the next chapter is the poem that Devorah the prophetess tells in exaltation of the victory over the Canaanites. "Blessed above women shall Yael be, the wife of Hever the Canaanite, above women in the tent shall be blessed. Water he asked, milk she gave him, and a lordly bowl she brought him curd. Her hand she put to the tent pin, and her right hand to the workman's hammer. With the hammer she smote Sisera, she smote through his head, yea, she pierced and struck through his temples. At her feet he sank, he fell, he lay. At her feet he sunk, he fell. Where he sunk, there he fell dead." So what I am trying to say is that we can see here how different literary themes can be combined to create a new story. We have the book of Yehudit, and we have the book of Judges. The book of Yehudit talks about a woman who seduces an enemy general who's come to conquer the Jewish people, and she gives him wine, he gets drunk, and she cuts off his head. In the book of Judges, we have a similar story, but different. In the book of Judges, we have a story of a woman who doesn't seduce the enemy general. He comes fleeing to her tent, but she gets him drowsy by giving him milk, and then cuts off his head and saves the Jewish people. And then later Jewish tradition takes, it's like a Chinese restaurant, one from A and one from B, and you put these together and you get a new story. You have the story of Yehudit, we keep her name, who seduces the enemy general in the book of Judith, it says with wine. From the book of Judges, we get the idea of getting the enemy woozy with milk and then cutting his head. So here is a way that we see the development of traditions. Now let's see another element. The Talmud tells a story about Yael, the woman who gave the milk and killed the enemy general when he was drowsy. And in the Talmud, it's a completely different subject, but the Talmud adds one element that's missing from the book of Judges. We'll just read this quickly. We'll just read one line. We'll read from the Babylon Talmud Tractate Nazir, page 23b, in line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Rabbi Yochanan said that wicked Resh Sisra had sevenfold intercourse with Yael at that time. That's all I want to show. So in other words, in the story of Yael, there's the enemy general, there's milk, there's cutting off the head, there's victory. But what's missing there is sex. The Talmud puts sex into it. The minute you put sex into it, you have another element in the combination. So now we can take Yehudit from the book of Yehudit, we could take the milk from the book of Judges, we can take the sexuality from the Babylonian Talmud and put it together and create a new story. And that's going to be the opening to another element. Then we'll take from the Babylonian Talmud what we saw half an hour ago, the idea of the bride who has to lie the first night with the enemy general. And we'll put all those things together and we'll create a new story. And then we'll take that story and set it in the time of Hanukkah. We're going to read now a midrash that puts all the elements together. And this midrash is probably the source for the current custom of milk on Hanukkah because of the deeds of Yehudit. Now, when was this midrash written that we're about to read? No one knows. Late antiquity or early Middle Ages. Might be the 6th century, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, the 10th. We don't know. But it's probably the midrash that the sources we've been talking about, the sources from the Middle Ages, are based upon. The Rambam, Rav Moshe Isserles, Rav Meir Yisrael Kagan, the whole story of Yehudit and Hanukkah and milk and virgin and cutting off his head, this is the way it developed in the form we know it today. This is my translation. And it came to pass at the beginning of the kingdom of Jerusalem that a certain ruler became jealous of Jerusalem and her inhabitants, and he and all of his army arose against her, against Jerusalem, and put her to the siege. He built a siege wall around her, and he didn't allow anyone to leave or enter, and the siege lasted many days. The famine in the city became very great. The walls were breached, and the ruler entered Jerusalem, overcame her, and conquered her, together with all the fortified cities of Judah. And he imposed a cruel rule upon them, and he took the wealth of the temple and all the palace for himself, and he imposed harsh punishment upon the countryside. And the inhabitants of Judah and Benjamin were humbled before him and could not lift up their heads. Three dots, I left some out. And the king called to all the men of Jerusalem and Judah, and they all came to him. And he said, "Listen to me, you heroic men will never be saved. I am God, and I am on the throne of God. I sit, there is none like me. You have no redeemer other than me who is in control from beginning to end." Three dots. "Your best young women, the most beautiful and most attractive, when they are to be married, you will bring them to me first and I will know them." Again, this is a midrash, a made-up story that's collecting elements from different sources we've seen in the past hour. "They were broken, they were devastated, but could not escape from the decree. The beautiful virgins fainted and cried out, 'God has discovered our sin and made a disgrace of us,' and they cried an awful cry. The king's words were implemented, and he had them brought to the palace, and he defiled the women and did lay with them. But the righteous women declared, 'For how long will this ensnare us? Behold, it is better for us to refrain from marriage than to be brought into his dwelling.' And so indeed was done. And the sound of joy and the sound of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride were no longer heard in the cities. Many days passed, and none were brought in to the king, as had been done before," because the Jews are on strike. They're not going to get married. time passed and the city was sad indeed, and the young women of Israel were troubled all their days as if they had been widowed. And as it became more and more burdensome, they gave themselves over to God and returned to him with all their heart, with all their soul. God from his dwelling heard their cry, and God brought them a Savior. His name was Judah. And a man greater than all those of his time, a valiant soldier and a man of war. He had a sister, both beautiful and wise. Her brothers were of a mind to find for a husband. And when they sought to have her become engaged, all the city was astir. Upon hearing of their plans, she cried out and begged them not to ask her to be betrothed, lest I be taken and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised. Where will I hide in my disgrace? And you, Judah, will be one of the knaves of Israel. Concerning you, storytellers will say, Judah has dealt treacherously, and abomination has he perpetrated. His sisters have they taken and afflicted. And when her brother heard his sister's words, they goaded him to righteous indignation. And he girded on his sword and proceeded to the king's palace, where the king was sitting on his throne, with his ministers to his right and to his left. And he appeared before the king girded with his sword, and the king made fun of him, saying, Peace be with you, Judah. Let your sister come that I may know her. And he responded, What is this about peace? Turn behind me. Do you think to make a whore of my sister? He drew his sword and cut off his head. According to this story, Judah was inspired to revolt against the king because of his sister. Right? And as well, all of the king's ministers and servants did he kill by the sword. And he emerged from there and sounded the shofar, and all the men of Israel gathered around him, and the Maccabean revolt began. According to the story, how did it begin? With a woman. And as you see, I have three dots there. I left out a lot. And when the king Aliforni heard that his brothers were dead, where did they get that from? Aliforni? It's a corruption of, what name did we see? Holofernes. Right? That's a corruption of the name of the enemy general in the book of Judith. And when the great king Aliforni heard that his brothers were dead, for the men of Israel had killed them and taken many prisoners, he was enraged and cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He gathered an army of many soldiers as the sand of the seashore, and the men of Israel were sorely afraid. Three dots are left out a lot. And when Judith, right, earlier it didn't give her a name. Now she has a name. I'm sorry, it did give a name. No, it didn't. It didn't give her name earlier. She's called Judith. And of course, it works out very well to take the name Judith from the book of Judith because she's the sister of Judah. Judah and Judith. It fits. And when Judith, the son of Judah, saw the great danger and the enormity of the peril, she took her life into her hands and went forth with her maidservants and came to the gate of the city. And to the gatekeeper she said, Open the gates and I'll go out. Perhaps God will make for me a miracle and I'll manage to kill the idolater and Israel will be saved through me. She dressed in her finest clothing and had placed the crown of royalty upon her head and made herself up. She was a splendid and a great beauty. This is now a paraphrase of the book of Judith, but it's being set in the time of Hanukkah. With the same woman, right, who is supposed to be married a few nights ago, but her brothers killed the ruler. And now, there's a war going on because they killed the ruler. The enemy general is coming to attack them. She's now going to go seduce the enemy general, as we're expecting. And she went out and came to the king Aliforni, and the soldiers saw her and praised her to the king, and she asked and said, Where's the tent of the king? And she went accompanied by a large throng, and when she came to the king, she bowed down to him to the ground. When he saw her, she found favor in his eyes, and he was confounded and asked, Who is this maiden? And she answered and said, I am of the women of Israel, and I have come today to throw myself before you and beg you for mercy. May your maidservant find favor in your eyes, and may you come take your slave under your wings. And the king said, Come and lay with me, my sister, for great is the love with which I love you, an exceedingly great love. And she made cakes and greatly salted them and placed them on the tray together with strips of curdled milk. And she took them and brought them inside to where Aliforni was. And Aliforni made a great feast, the feast of Yehudit. He consumed the cakes and the strips of curdled milk, and he drank and became very merry. He became drunk and lay down to sleep. And when Yehudit saw that he had drunk until drunkenness and had fallen on the ground and that no one was there with her, she rose up on her legs and spread her hands heavenward. Please God, make your servant successful today and save me. And she took the sword and quietly approached him in his slumber, and she raised both hands and struck his head and killed him. And then she cut off his head. Now, in this Midrash, it doesn't say that she killed him the same night she was brought into the ruler in order to be ravished. That is a later development. So you see all these ideas and all these elements and all these themes that over the course of 1,000 years are brought together to create a new story. And the moral of the new story is go to Tom Thumb and buy cheese.